Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you for joining us at Reform to Freedom Ministries, where we share stories of those who have triumphed over challenges beyond the prison bars. Hear credible testimonies from prison advocates, social activists, and legal experts which can bring impeachment. Join us each Thursday at noon for the latest.
And good morning, and welcome to Reform to Freedom Ministries. Of course, this is your movie, or this is your digital mogul, Diane Whitbush. I am your host on today, and so we have a very special guest that's in our studio because we have been talking about for the last several months in regards to prisoners. We've been talking about injustices. We have had legal representation that has been on the broadcast sharing information, tools, and resources as to how you can be able to get your voice heard. And also, we also give information to family members as to how they can be able to advocate when we have issues with inside of the prison bars as to how prisoners and ex-offenders and offenders are being treated. So today we have an actress, speaker, and she's an advocate as well for reform justice, and she is none other than Miss Marie Dunnigan. So good morning and welcome to the broadcast on today.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Okay, great. So we're going to first get started. We're going to let the audience kind of learn a little bit about you and then as to how you got started and what have you in the field of what you do in regards to fighting for justice, and we'll go from there, okay?
Okay, sounds fine. Again, my name is Maria Dunnigan, and I have a history of being an executive director for the Miss America system for about 16 years, and I worked as a buyer as an overseas electronics buyer for many years, along with doing pageant work. A few years ago, 9 to be exact, I watched a OWN Network documentary that was featured on Netflix called Serving Life, and it was about the hospice program that they have at the Louisiana State Penitentiary, where they had inmates volunteering as hospice volunteers helping the dying there because of the fact that so many men that go to Louisiana State Penitentiary are there on life without parole sentences, and ultimately many of them die there. And one of the gentlemen that was featured on the show, his name is Justin Granier. His story spoke to me in that he received a life sentence, and he was 19 years old going in. And what he was doing with his life behind bars and his harsh sentencing really had a statement to me, and so I reached out and became an advocate for him.
Okay, wow, that is awesome, because Maria, we're seeing a lot of over-sentencing in the U.S. today. I mean, I've never heard of some of the sentencing, and I don't even know that if certain individuals, when they're incarcerated, that they have this website, I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think it's ussa.gov or something like that, where they can go in and they can access that link and be able to check to see if the judge is actually giving them the appropriate sentencing. So I don't understand as to why. And I know, you know, we've had some attorneys on the podcast talking about in regards to, you know, sometimes it may be a little business that may be affiliated with it. You know how sometimes we may go in there and we may turn an issue into a project, and the project comes into a monetary thing where we get, you know, we incarcerate a lot of people. Sometimes institutions cannot get funding, and police departments cannot get funding unless they have enough prisoners that are in their beds, in their location. So
exactly.
That's the next question I wanted to, for you, if you would, to be able to share a little bit about if you have any experience in regards to the audience about that.
Well, prison enterprise is definitely a real thing. State run, I think, you know, I can't prove it, obviously, but I believe that, you know, prosecutors work together with state funded penitentiaries in order to bring down harsh sentences if possible, bring them into the prison, and then, of course, taxpayers have to pay out of their tax money to fund each inmate annually. And then some of these inmates, once they start working on a program that will allow partial release, like a work release program, they're also working together with prison and the prison enterprise, where the inmate will go to work, and when they get their pay, the entity, whichever entity is working together with the prison, will ultimately get the majority, the pay, the salary of the inmate. That ends up paying for the buses that transport them, all the things that are included in getting this inmate to have some work release program for his own benefit. But really the benefit is more towards the prison enterprise, because the inmate doesn't really get that much money. And so it's a struggle from the time they get into prison, the time they spend in prison, and the time they're in a work release program. So it's very hard on an inmate, and it ultimately makes it harder for them to survive. And that is why a lot of inmates end up back in prison.
Okay. And so it's several institutions I know, and as you stated earlier in your last comment in regards to we don't have proof, and that's the thing about it. It's a gray area that's there in regards to it's a gray area in there is in regards to proving the fact of the institutions or law enforcement or the DA, the district attorneys, are working with the prosecutors and things like that in order to be able to, because, you know, it puts the inmate or the prisoner, I can't stop doing that and things, it puts the offender, that's the word that we're trying to use, it puts the offender in a position where they are just like a ham sandwich. They're the cheese and the ham, and you got the prosecutor and the DA, which we're not, you know, we're not here to try to beat anybody down, but we're just making facts. But because and then here's the public defender or the paid, sometimes it's a paid attorney. I was not aware of that until it was given to me that about a few weeks ago, that the paid attorney sometimes will even feed their own client to the prosecutor. It is sad to say it is. I don't want to laugh, but it is sad to say that. I know the public defenders will, because they work for the state. But I was told from a source that went through this process of that. And so, you know, when it comes to prison reform, we should be working with programs on the inside of the institution. You know what? Our organization, our whole goal is getting to the core of the person. If we can't get to the core of the person as to why they're in there, I can go to a program that's dealing with trying to get my GED while I'm behind bars or something like that. But what about this issue that I may have substance abuse, and the institutions are not providing those type? They have substance abuse classes or support groups, but they do not have courses where they can be able to take them while they are incarcerated. So I guess that would be our next discussion that I would like to bring to the light, as to what other strategies, in your terms, that you feel that could be able to help the prisoner while they're incarcerated?
Well, my experience is with the Louisiana State Penitentiary, which in one way offers a wide variety of educational programs for rehabilitation. They have a reentry program. In Justin's case, he has earned his associate's and his bachelor's degree while in prison in Christian ministry. The biggest problem with inmates that are given shorter terms, they don't really have those programs. They make them go through, you know, a certification process so that they can have some education behind it, but not any long-term education behind it. It's sort of just like an area that they have to go through. Then when they provide long-term information and programs for lifers don't have the opportunity to come home. So it's really being, I don't want to say wasted on them because they can't come home, but they need to provide the same education process with anybody that's entering prison for more than at least 4 or 5 years so that they do have the opportunity to get educated, stay educated, recommit to whatever their issue may be, whether it's sobriety, anger management, and so forth, so that that recidivism isn't as great as it is with inmates that have shorter term sentencing. And so it is difficult, and not all prisons provide that for you. And that is a big problem. Okay. They need to have that in there. Otherwise, you know, we're just going to have continued return to prison.
Okay. So let's shift gears a little bit. Let's talk about a little bit about Justin. And with or without, I mean, it's your choice. And depending on how much, you know, I'm pretty sure he's, if you've been advocating for him for a long time, I always make sure that when I reach out to prisoners or they reach out to our organization that, you know, I always tell them, you know, I don't have to share this, or the door knob is on your handle, on the side of your door. So with Justin, tell us a little bit about him. And I know you told me that you told the audience that he has gotten certain certificates and degrees while he's been there and what have you. So tell us a little bit about him and about his progress.
Okay, well, I'll just briefly tell you about the incident. He was charged with second-degree murder. He was coerced during his confession time without an attorney, and during trial, his attorney suggested that he admit to having some knowledge of what happened in effort to get a manslaughter charge. So he was coerced into making false statements, which ultimately hurt him, which ultimately provided him with a mandatory life without parole, suspension of sentence situation. In Louisiana, they give mandatory sentencing and have this archaic practice of doing that. And basically, if somebody has something to do with a crime, they can ultimately get the same exact sentence as the person who did, and that's what happened in Justin's case. He was, after the fact, being a 19-year-old kid, didn't do what he was supposed to do. And so as a result, he did get the same exact sentence as his two co-defendants. Well, one of them is already out. He took a plea bargain. However, since being in prison, Justin has tried to do everything that he can to better himself by doing every possible course study that they have provided, anger management, going to college for theology. It hasn't been easy. They go up and down. They can fall down. They can rebuild. And it's really tough on them either way because the prison has so many restrictions. They don't really like to have people advocating for them. They want to keep them in there. Even the parole and clemency process is difficult because in that time, it's almost like because they're the prosecutors and victims are allowed to be a part of that, they end up going over what their crime was and what they did during that crime or after the fact, and instead of looking at exactly how they've rebuilt themselves. And that's you know, a huge problem. But for Justin, he's on year 19. He is trying to rebuild and refocus. Mm-hmm. And within the next couple of years, he will have the opportunity to apply for clemency. In the meantime, his case is in federal court, which has been pending there for 2 years. We are hoping to have a reversal of sentence or possibly a new trial, which he did have a biased juror on his original trial, and that's what one of our main claims are in effort to get his freedom. I believe that he will not be any kind of a danger to anyone once he comes home, but an asset, and plans to work with young children that may have issues like he did growing up with drugs and making wrong decisions. And he also is very interested in the medical field and possibly becoming a lawyer to help other people in his position.
And I think I feel strongly that that can be accomplished. Thank you for your comments on that. I think that can strongly be accomplished. I kind of get in there with several of the prison reform groups that are on social media. I try to be a mediator, I guess, if you will, for some of them, because a lot of them, they will they will reveal too much information. And so in regards to that, and I want to explain that a little bit, I think it was something, it was a question I was asking while joining because it was in regards to an offender. And so when I went in there and asked the question, it was attorneys popped up everywhere. And so that's what I try to help them to be able to understand on those platforms on social media, that there are judges. They conceal their profiles. Their attorneys are in there, and they're trying to build a case, you know, even against their own, I'm sorry to say it, against their own clients. So, and they usually listen. They'll come. I think the one lady I told them, she said, well, and she's going through a very traumatic issue. They took out the wrong organ for her loved one, her husband, and then they I think it's done erupted or something like that. So the fact they had another organ that was repairable. I don't know what was going on and things, but you can feel that they're not telling stories. This is honest thing. You can feel it. And so I told her, I said, whatever's going on, you know, some of the stuff you need to be talking privately on social media regards to all of these groups that you're exposing, all of these things about, you're going to take down these people, you're going to sue these people. That's the wrong thing to do. Take, for example, something small like what my father had did. He had went in there and he was just, he's deceased now. Oh, I'm going to sue my company for messing up my legs, blah, blah, blah. And so all of the people in the community worked in this same location that he worked in as well. And so with that being said, he was leaking out too much information in regards to how his attorneys were moving forward with his case. And when he got to court and things, they only, after attorney fees and everything, he only got $7,000 from this huge automobile corporation. I'm not going to call their name out, but it was a huge automobile corporation. And he was not only, he was able to only bring home just a small fraction because of his mouth. And that's what I tried to help the family members in these advocate groups on social media. Don't share everything. There are people in here with hidden profiles, and they popped up out of nowhere when I went in there and asked this question back here several months ago. And I said, oh my gosh, and I went in there and I took it down. I took the post, the question that I was asking, I took it down. So in regards to that, as you stated, that's their job. They want to keep the individuals incarcerated. They don't want, and I don't understand for the fact of it, is that they don't mind the church people coming in, because we're kind of, our organization is on both of them. It's on a Christian level, and it's also on an advocate level. They don't mind that, but if it's another, like the Innocence Project that comes through the door, they'll try to do everything to try to block every means from that person becoming free and trying to, and that's why the reform comes in at. So that's
exactly,
that's just something. Go ahead if you want to elaborate on that, because that's just something I don't understand, as you should want the person to be better There's so much COVID-19 that's going on. Prisoners are dying behind bars with COVID-19. You should want some type of release for these prisoners.
Well, I think, you know, without, you know, trying to say anything bad about the system more than they say for themselves, in regards to what you said about letting religious community come into the prison, you know, it's a right, they have a right to, you know, religious practice. And so that kind of gives the open door for that. And so as far as Innocence Projects or Project or any other entities that are trying to help bring people's stories to light, and they do like to do that because what happens is that it's an actual exposure to some of the harsh realities that inmates face, whether it's men or women in that are being incarcerated. And so, you know, if we're out here trying to advocate for someone, if you say anything that goes against the prison, we end up getting into trouble for it, and ultimately our incarcerated loved ones get into trouble for it, and they are made to pay a higher price than they already do in terms of being told what to do, when to do, how to do it. And so it's very difficult to advocate and walk that blurry line, because you just never know what you may or may not say that's going to hit the nerve of somebody on, like you said, those fake profiles. They're watching us. They're, you know, taking into account everything that we're saying. But it is our right as advocates to have our free speech and to advocate for anyone that we feel we want to, that has been given harsh sentences, you know, that has been coerced, that, and what we would really like to do is be able to talk about the harsh realities that they live every day. But we have to be careful, and that's why we have to focus on, you know, different ideas about what happened in the case and what we're going to do moving forward for change, for prison reform, and to make the lives of our incarcerated loved ones easier while they know that we are out here fighting the fight for them.
Louisiana and the state of Mississippi, and then we're going to, after we elaborate on this topic here, we're going to move into some of the consequences of the actions and of the harsh sentencing of what you would like to share with the audience. But the state of Mississippi and the state of Louisiana, they have the harshest. I don't understand it, and like I said, we're not here to bash any institution or any, you know, whether it's the Bureau of Prisons and things. I was telling this one ex-offender and stuff, oh, we're going to take down the BOP. I said, no, you're going to take down the BOP. I'm not going to get involved with that, but I'll let you do that. But anyways, they have the harshest prisons, and I'm not for sure as to why, especially like Parchment. There was a documentary on Dateline, and I think it was the anchorman or the anchorman that runs it for 5:30 evening news on NBC, and Lester Holt, that's his name. And so he went in there and he stayed behind bars for like 2 nights and 3 days, and then he was able to go through the process of this one prisoner. He had been there for probably about 60 years, and I think at that time he at the documentary that aired, I don't know, in March or something of this year, he
they denied
his parole, and I'm not for sure why that happened. He's an older guy. This guy's about 80 something years old, and I'm like, wait a minute, what's the issue? And this is what I want you to elaborate on. If the person, what can he do if he's released at the age of, I'm not for sure the accuracy of his age, whether it's 86 or 87, but I know that gentleman has been locked up for about 60 some odd years. What is it that he could be able to harm to society? after all of those years? And why does parchment be so? Because, see, the governor, I think it's Tate Reeves or Reeves Tate or whatever his name is for the governor of Mississippi, he just went and flat out and said, no, I'm not signing no bill for no reform for none of the prisons in the state of Mississippi. And I know it's some things are money-making things, but I just don't understand. He has the poorest state in the U.S. Why is it that you would not want to see your individuals, your offenders, to be able to get the programs that they need? I guess that's the question.
Well, I believe it goes back to that prison enterprise. It's an unspoken conversation that prison enterprise doesn't want to have with outside public on why they keep their inmates there. It can be from the crimes they committed, what they've done while they've been in prison to reform and rehabilitate themselves, if provided the necessary tools to do so, I might add. And so they don't really want to say what it is that keeps them there, but it's basically that prison. It's about, in my opinion, it's about the money, and they've got it. They have to help the prosecutors keep their case and keep their money coming in with new prisoners, ones that come back to prison, and just keep them there because it is a money-making enterprise. So I think that's part of it. Not allowing men to come out of prison after being there for so many years, I think, is also part of the same thing. They want to say, this is a man who committed a murder, heinous or otherwise, and they're going to stick to their story and they're not going to allow him to come out. I mean, at his age, he wouldn't be doing anything, you know, and there's so many cases that go underneath that particular gentleman's name that they try to fight their own cases based on what his case is. And after all of these years, he should have been shown leniency. He should have been out living the rest of his life and not die in prison like so many men and women do. Louisiana is the prison capital of the world, and it's because of those archaic, mandatory, automatic sentencing that says, boom, this is what your sentence is going to be, life without parole, and they ship you off to whatever housing they're going to put you in, and that's pretty much where it ends. And so it's kind of a very blurry line. They're not going to admit why they're doing that, but in our advocate perception and understanding, that's exactly what it is. And a lot of times, there's a gentleman that's at Louisiana State Penitentiary that is such a model prisoner that works for them, that teaches for them, that does everything he's supposed to do for them. They don't want to get rid of him because they're going to have to replace him with somebody else. So they're going to continue to deny his opportunity to be released. That's what they do.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. That is really something. That is really something. And just like I was stating, and I was kind of furious with the governor, you know, sometimes we can go to the polls, we can vote for individuals, and we don't even know who we're voting for simply because of the fact we see, we're going to do this, and we're going to do this for health care, I'm not anything against the governor or anything like that, but I would think that if you provide the prison reform programs for the offenders while they are there, then that's income and tax, more taxes for the state once the prisoner gets out and he begins to develop something brand new for his life or what have you and things, and then that will also build revenue, you know, it'll build income for the state. And I just don't understand why he doesn't see it like that, but you know, that's his choice. And of course, when I saw it, I was kind of a little furious. I'm like, you're not going to help any of your people, and it appears that they're not helping none of the governors are trying to. It seems like they're trying to keep them there. This is what this is for. You know, back in the day, you used to have institutions where they go out and you know, had to gather their own food and stuff like peas and corn and things like that. Well, you don't see that rarely in some of the institutions, but you see it in the state of Mississippi, and you still see it in Louisiana, where they still have these prison farms where they plant these big, huge gardens and just fill them with all types of vegetables, and which is good now. Organic food is delicious, but what I'm just saying is just, like, you know, some people have moved on beyond that, and it seems like that those two locations have not. It seems like they want to keep everything in the past, and they don't want to do anything to try to better things for the future for anybody. They just want to keep it that way. So, I mean, and that's their cup of tea, and that's okay. This is what we're going to talk about next, and this is in regards to your program, what you advocate for. What are some of the strategies that an offender can expect if they come to your establishment, to your organization? What are some of the strategies that they can be able to expect? Because, and the reason why I ask that question, okay, and so it's a prisoner, one of the prisoners that we are advocating for. I went and tried to contact one of the project areas in, it was an Innocence Project, but that's not the name of it. I won't call out the name of the organization. Oh, instead of them trying to give me resources or any type of feedback, they just went on a rant and stuff. Oh, I'm surprised. The reason why you're trying to reach out to us, trying to help him, we can help him and stuff. He shows up. And that's my thing. If a person is an advocate, that's the last thing that they should be doing, is misjudging a offender or misjudging the family member or misjudging anyone, especially if you are an advocate yourself. Why would you be critical towards any offender? And that's, you're in the business to try to help, you know, families or anyone. So that's what I did. I went in and I tried to get some information in regards to what they could be able to do. And that's the reason why we turned advocate, and that's the reason why we started our own organization for prison reform offenders, so we can be able to reach out, because I just have it. I just, that kind of infuriated me. You're getting government dollars, this organization is, and you're in the business to help offenders and be able to encourage them in whatever methods that they were using to be able to bring them closer to having a better and a successful life, regardless if they're behind bars or not. And so the organization was very critical. I still have the email right now. I printed it out. I thought it was very harsh and stuff. Oh, I'm not surprised that they're not treating him any better than that and stuff. He's in a maximum security. Oh, she just went on and on and on. And I thought that was very biased and prejudiced for her, not in racial terms, but it was prejudice of her comments. So why do we see sometimes in your terms, why do we see that? And then the part two to that question is, what are some of the strategies and methods that you use to be able to educate prisoners as to, you know, about their actions and how they, you know, do things, and then what can they do to not do that again so things can be a little bit better? Because sometimes it can be hard to turn. My issue with that is, I think it's environment. If we get out and we go back to our same old environment and things, that's going to pull that same plug. So I'm going to let you finish. I'm not going to say anything else. I'm just going to let you elaborate on that.
Okay, well, you know, it's not surprising sometimes to hear advocates not having more open mind. The only thing I could say in that regard is, for that particular person or anybody like that, is they may just be focused in on their particular person. And being an advocate, you have to advocate for anybody that has a possibility of coming out and being reformed and being a working member of society, and that's what the most important thing is. I govern myself with like-minded people. I work with the Hope Foundation in Louisiana, where we are helping others evolve We try to bring information that's happening inside of prison, outside of prison, prison reform, any entities that will provide positive reinforcement to our incarcerated loved ones. We're also working, I'm also working with Jason Flom. He is one of the founding members of the Innocence Project, which is now all over the United States, and Vote in Louisiana. And so my recommendation is anybody that's doing advocacy work, they all have a primary person that they're helping, but they should always be open to anybody else that you can give information to help them. Because without that, they will stay in prison. They will stay in their same mind that they went into prison. They will not evolve, and they will not see how it is the course that they need to take in order to come out and to decide what they're going to do when they get out, taking themselves away from why they got there and how they're going to live for the rest of their lives without that same core, environment that they had before going in. So it's really all about being around like-minded advocates, doing the right thing for everyone that's involved, including the gentleman we were talking about, Henry Montgomery, that's in the Louisiana State Penitentiary. It's working together and working for all of them. Everyone needs a second chance.
Absolutely. I agree with that. And even in regards, to that, I was sharing with a prisoner. I used to work for the U.S. Marshals myself some years ago. And then once it, became clear to me as to the monetary benefits and efforts of offenders being incarcerated, that's the reason why I was I said, well, I don't think that I really want to be a part of it. So that's the reason why that was one of the decisions, the reason why I made to leave the institution at that time. And that's because I've kind of felt, we would get bonus checks in regards to so many beds that were filled and things. So could I prove that in a court of law? No, I cannot. But with that being said, I just did not want to be guilty of association because I felt it strongly. I'm like, oh, wow, we just went in there and we just arrested about, so many hundreds of immigrants and stuff. It would be immigrants and state and federal prisoners. And I said, but every time we would arrest a lot of them, here come the barbecues, the cookouts, you get a check. And I'm like, wait a minute, something is wrong. And then after I kept, just working and working and working, and it became more and more clear to me that this is a business now. This is not something where the individuals are put behind bars and, just to, say, oh, hey, you committed this crime. It's not about that anymore. It don't have anything to do with it. This is a hotel. You know, each bed costs, I think, in some institutions, it costs like $62 a night just for them. So it's a business. They have found a way to turn the monetary efforts of it, of if this is no longer a crime, you committed a crime, but they focus more on how many beds can I fill. And so what in the institution that I worked in, they get shifted around. I'm like, wait a minute, we just took this guy out 2 weeks ago, and he's back over here again, and now he's going to go back over here to another state. And so when they do it that way, they're trying to make sure they're helping everybody out that may have a low volume of prisoners that are at their institution. So if they go in there and shift these prisoners around to these different locations, that still give this warden a good, that his hands is washed, if I could be able to use that term. And if he goes over here to Oklahoma, this institution right here, their hands are washed. And after I began to go through a series, almost 10 years with that, I said, I don't want to be guilty of being participant in that, even though the funds look good, but it was I felt that I was doing it because this is somebody's life. And so that's the reason why I departed from that. And no, nothing against the institution, nothing against the agency or anything like that, but it's just individual individuals have to wake up. They have to wake up, and those that have to wake up are the ones that are committing the crimes, and they are putting the sentencing out there. So it's so tall now. It's so long, and when they put the sentencing out there, it's like, well, if I scratch my leg the wrong way, I'm going in. But if I go in for blowing my nose or maybe spitting saliva on side of the sidewalk, and I got previous charges that I've already did 4, 5, or 10 years ago, well, it's going to put me in the slammer for 30 years.
Yep, it's true. You're right. They look at everything, run you through a fine-tooth comb, and you're right. It's about prevention, number one, knowing what they're in for, knowing what your state's rules and regulations are regarding imprisonment, and what to not do to get there. Because it's easy to get into prison. It takes a lifetime to get out of prison. And so, you know, that's the biggest thing is prevention and education. And meanwhile, advocates are working very hard to have prison reform so that we can eliminate these long, horrible sentences that some men and women are getting and living a life in incarceration. So it's about change and about coming together. We might be advocating individually for someone, but ultimately we have to look out for everyone.
Okay, okay. So does your organization, so take for instance like an offender, I don't want to use the word prisoner, an offender, if you're working with them, do you all help them through the process of perhaps maybe partnering with other third-party organizations where they can be able to get them a job or what have you? And I'm going to share something with you, and this is going to really probably finna flip you out. I went to this domestic, and I loved it. I'm loving this conversation. I'm serious. I love this energy in this conversation. I went to speak at a domestic violence center. It was real nice, brand new, polished up and everything. And the location has like a 211. Most of your major cities do. They have like a 211 where you can, you know, be able to get information as to, you know, food, shelter, clothes, jobs, all kinds of stuff. And I knew that this director was not giving this lady, because even though they are running from their spouses, perhaps that have, you know, perhaps mentally, sexually, or physically abused them, to me, it still felt like it was a prison ward. They were withholding jobs from them because our organization was a link, and we provide resources in that area as well. And the lady just came in there, and after I did the presentation, she just broke down and she just started crying. And the counselor was like, "Oh, I'm sorry, we don't have no job openings and things. You know, job opening in the city." And I know she was telling her a story, and that was not true. And it seems like she was trying to keep all of those beds filled, okay, in that domestic violence shelter, which was very polished and brand new. She seems like she was trying to keep those people there by not giving them jobs, because if they get jobs, then they have to, they can't be able to stay within the program. And so that would be the next discussion that I would like to talk about. We got just about a few more minutes now, but that would be the next discussion. And I know we've already shared some things in regards to why they hold them down, and that's because of the money efforts of it and what have you. But does your organization offer a strategy process as to, okay, take for instance, we're going to use Justin as a prime example. Justin's he had his parole hearing and things, and which, wish everything the best for him within those 2 years that's coming up. If does your organization, or you are working on a strategy to be able to work with third party individuals, like for jobs for him when he come out, which he has, you know, a degree already. And do you work with trying to change his location and his environment to try to get him housed with a third-party individual as well?
Well, with Justin, he is going to be coming home to a job and to a large supportive family, a place to live.
Okay.
He is not typical to many inmates, incarcerated loved ones, as we call them, that has the same future coming out of prison. So
okay.
With Justin, he does, you know, he's in a different situation. However, with the Hope Foundation, with Boat Louisiana, with Rising Foundation in New Orleans, these are all different organizations that help provide information on how to be able to be self-sustaining once you come out. Sadly, there are a lot of different places that don't actually have the financial benefit as a prison enterprise has in order to
okay.
provide them a place to live, money to go on, and a job. So it's really important once they are getting ready to come out of prison to be educated on what they're going to be doing next. And Hope Foundation, Vote, Rising Foundations, and a variety of other organizations do provide help for men and women coming out of prison. So it's very important for people to know that, and very important to other organizations to engage with the other, so that we, because there are so many men and women incarcerated across the land, to work together to provide this information to them, to give them help, and show them the way, because there is life after prison. We just have to make sure that they have that availability to know who we are, where we are, and what we can do for them. So that's really the main thing, is working together and trying to get, you know, all of this support out to them. And so, yes, all of the organizations that I've spoken about today do just that. One's help prepare for parole and clemency education. Others help evolve them from prison life and moving forward, and other ones provide jobs for men and women that have been incarcerated, which is very difficult for them to move on if they don't have, like, the support that Justin may have or others like Justin.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And this will be the last question, and so this is in regards to a true story that is going on right now. So one of the individuals that is in the state of Tennessee, he's up for execution on December the 3rd, and so it was an incident that happened, and he was accused of it, and the district attorney in that location, Shelby County, and things. We're not going to get no DNA testing and things. And so what happened was the Innocent Project got involved. It was the NAACP got involved, and it was other organizations. And I think Impact makes a big deal when it comes to a prisoner, as you just were saying in so many words. If they don't have anyone to support them, then they slip through. They just go, you know, they just go all the way, trigger all the way down the system and what have you. But at the last minute, these organizations came together and made a huge impact. It was a big news media thing. And so that's what they did. The district attorney was trying to prohibit them from even testing to see if the DNA belonged to the prisoner or not. And so she went in there and did all of that, and all of these organizations came in there together and formed, just like you see on Planet Earth. I don't know if you watched that, which is a National Geographic type of film.
Mm-hmm.
And so what the bisons do when they have had babies and things, and they're trying to protect them, and maybe like a fox or something tries to come up and try to get the baby and things, they'll form a huddle around their little bitty ones.
Exactly.
And so that's what these organizations did. They formed a huddle, and it was huge around this inmate or this prisoner or this offender. They and right now today, as we speaking, they was able to go in and run completely over. I hate to use that word like that, but they ran completely. They trampled that district attorney down, and so now his DNA is out for testing.
That's right, which it should have been presented right from the beginning.
Right. Exactly. And so the Innocence Project was in there in the court system. It was all on the news. This was about a month ago. And they was in there trying to, you know, ask for the judge. And she just in there trying to, you know, put her two cents in there and things like that. And so once they got in there and they formed a huge huddle and got all of those other mm-hmm. organizations, plus the offender, his daddy is like a big thing in one of these Christian organizations and stuff. He's like a bishop or something. And all of those people piled up on top of this district attorney. And I said, look at that. She tried to block. They went in there and formed a huddle and ran her straight over. So the judge now, he granted the DNA testing where they can be able to permit present new evidence, and the prisoner have been locked up for 32 years. You see what I'm saying? That's a long time
yes.
for me to have to wait in a maximum institution just to get my DNA tested, and while these district attorneys are trying to block it. So hopefully, you know, it'll be some relief coming where he can be able to get that access. And like you said, some of them are not fortunate, you know, maybe because of the educational mindset, I'm not for sure,
mm-hmm.
or it could be some project, Innocent Projects organizations may feel that they may not have enough to go forward in order to help them, because that's what we'll tell them. What we do, we refer prisoners out, and we'll tell them, look, I told this one lady, and she has a huge following, but I said, no, we can't do it that way. You can't, because you can't let the family members come in there and tell you how to run your organization, because you have to have proof, you have to have facts, you have to have evidence. You can't just jump in there and say da 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 da. You have to be able to be willing to, you know, offer up some information. So, anyway,
exactly.
I know I said a nutshell. So, if you want to elaborate on that, you can for the next couple of minutes, and then after that, you can be able to share with the audiences how they can be able to follow you if you desire for them to, or follow your project, or follow your brand, and then we'll be able to conclude this wonderful podcast.
Okay, well, you basically said everything in a nutshell regarding the fact that each inmate, just because they are incarcerated, doesn't mean that they don't have any rights to their own case. And so especially now with DNA, the way that it has scientifically gotten so much better, each case shouldn't have to wait years and years and years in order to reap the benefit of science.
Mm-hmm.
And so people do, our organizations do need to come together, whether it's, regardless of what state you're in, we're all doing, you know, the same work for the same benefit. And so that's the key. You know, I think that it's just really important that everybody understands that everyone in prison doesn't necessarily need to be there, and everyone in prison doesn't necessarily need to be going through harsh conditions because of poor mistakes. So everybody should be given a chance, even if they're not able to come out of prison. They still shouldn't have to live the way that they live and be looked upon as they are, including the way advocates are looked upon. So that's the first thing. And I really appreciate you providing us a platform to talk about our different organizations that are really, truly trying to help others. That would be the Hope Foundation that runs on Facebook and Instagram. Vote in Louisiana. There's Rising Foundations also in Louisiana. And support Innocence Project with Jason Flom. And get involved, do what you can, and don't worry about what people think about you, because they're going to think something no matter what. So I thank you so much for giving us this opportunity to speak on behalf of our incarcerated loved ones and prison reform and being an advocate.
Mm-hmm. Great, and we certainly rooting for Justin and that and for the other offenders that you support and others are supporting, and I wanted to share also that I think that's the reason why Kim Kardashian is working so strongly on, I think, if I'm not mistaken, she's going for an attorney too after she went in there and freed, and I can't think of her name right off the bat, but the lady, she got freed, and she went in there to the President of the United States and went in there and asked them to, you know, overturn her conviction. And so even with that being said, and I think that's kind of, you know, she saw the massive incarceration as to how much, how many people are being incarcerated and how they're being mistreated. And so I really applaud her for that in that area. So you are welcome. Thank you for being our guest on today, Maria. So you all have received much information, tools, and resources from Maria Dunnigan, who is also an advocate. She's a background actress, and she's an author as well. And she's also, as you can see, she's a speaker. So she's provided all of this information for us today so we can be able to take authority, charge, take initiative on our loved ones. Don't sit there and allow them to be behind bars and don't say anything. There's a lot of talking on social media, but you have to act. You have to act on things. It's just not good enough just to talk. So this is your show host, of course, Ms. Diane Woodbush, and we thank you all for being on the show on today. And until next time, we say take care of yourselves. Be safe and be blessed. Thank you.